wanted to make an announcement. We've had on the schedule SJR6.
SJR6.
And somehow or another, we didn't get the word out to a few of the folks, so we're going to try to reschedule that with somewhere near the same time that Senator Morissette has a rural issue coming up in his committee, I believe. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that was my bad.
I don't know exactly how we can do that. At least it'll have to be one day apart. But
yeah, that was my bad, and I will be in contact with those people who are working on the measures and certainly with Chair Morissette and see if we can coordinate if everybody's interested, and we'll move on from there.
And I have no folder of papers here somewhere or another, so I don't even have a schedule to see which folder.
Okay, well, there you go.
Thank you. I'll open a, hope a short public hearing on Senate Bill 326.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 326 had its initial public hearing on the 12th of February. It allocates lottery funds to the Office of Rural Health for rural health clinics. And we have the Dash 2 amendment that was discussed at that time, which would clarify that the rural health clinics are federally certified rural health clinics that would receive these funds. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means because of the amount of money appropriated in the bill.
Okay. And we have Joy Soares, and she wishes to come and testify concerning, I believe, the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joy Suarez. I'm a safety net access developer for Care Oregon. Care Oregon is a private, not-for-profit, 501c3 health plan that serves 70,000 low-income Oregon health plan members. We're in 16 counties, both rural and urban, and we want to support the bill and this amendment. However, we are also encouraging the legislature to also support funding the entire safety net clinic, both urban and rural. We are encouraging a community approach that asks for local hospitals, primary care providers, as well as specialty providers from both the public and private sector to work with our local safety net clinics to come up with a stopgap solution to provide basic health care services for the medically vulnerable. Pooling our creative community talents and financial resources presents Oregon with the Oregonians with an opportunity and a possible solution. So we are also encouraging you to support House Bill 2970, which supports the entire safety net clinic, all the safety net clinics, both urban and rural. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Yes, Senator Burdick.
Chair, I don't know if this is a question for the witness, but I wonder if it would make more sense to wait for the other bill to do them both together.
Well, I went to all the trouble to get permission to send this on down to Ways and Means, and I don't know if I want to take a chance on coming back to it again. A strike while the iron's hot. If there's any problems with it, they can certainly work that out in Ways and Means, I would say, if one coincides or conflicts or adds to the other. Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would expect that we'll see that that House bill goes to Ways and Means as well, and that's the place where they will come together. Yeah. And so I would certainly want to move this on to Ways and Means today.
Okay. Anyone else in the audience have anything they wish to say concerning this? Seeing no takers, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 326 and open a work session on Senate Bill 326.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 326 to Ways and Means.
You got an amendment.
I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 326.
This is the Dash 2. Okay. Senator Morissette has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 326. Any discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Clarno? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. And this will go to Ways and Means.
You need another motion.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me. We've accepted the amendment.
Okay.
Senator Morissette.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 326 as amended to Ways and Means with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 326 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Farno? Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 326 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 401.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 401 had its initial public hearing on the 24th of February. It's related to newborn hearing screening. We do have the Dash 1 amendment that clarifies the department will work within their existing resources to implement the program. It clarifies that the hospitals, birthing centers, diagnostic facilities, and educational institutions working in good faith, people can't maintain action for damages against those people, and that the institution shall disclose information to the department about these children who have been identified with hearing disorders and those that are receiving early intervention services only on consent of parents.
Thank you. We have Tammy Phillips and Jenna Ingram.
Hello, my name is Tammy Phillips, and I'm here on behalf of Oregon State Grange, and it's 15,000 members plus. I'm the State Director of the Deaf Activities and Awareness, and I have a severe hearing loss. I forgot to give you the extra paper.
That's all right. We'll.
Okay. I'm here to try to impress on you the importance of a speedy follow-up and the medical care that follows once the baby has been found having an incredible hearing testing result. I have taken days and talked about all the children and that I have grown up with and the special process and tutoring. And I can tell you about my mother and my grandfather, who was a doctor and who took the time and the energy to talk to me and to teach me things, and in doing so, imprint on the spoken word onto my mind as the hearing world in phase. That is so when I am fitted with my hearing aids, I can remember how the words are sound and come to be. Sooner that the child can become tested and fitted for any needed equipment and is enrolled in any special educational program, the better the possibility that the child's hearing can be maximized. The first introduction to communication for the child is the parent and the grandparent. They are asked usually the first to discover the hearing loss. By then, the delay of the hearing places that child in a situation where they have to play catch-ups with their peers. And for every 6 months going untreated, the further behind the child will become. There are studies, and I have backup paperwork on that, that show children identifying at birth with a mild to severe hearing loss that receive access to early intervention programs falls within normal range of language comprehension and expression, as well as increased personal and social development. In contrast, children who are born deaf and hard of hearing that are identified after 6 months of age experience significant delays in both language and personal and social development. Thanks to previous actions by the Oregon legislature, newborns are finally being tested before they leave the hospital here in Oregon. But there are new problems beginning to surface. Once diagnosed with hearing loss, some of these children are not receiving the early intervention services they need to enable to communicate and develop into a productive citizen. Either because of lack of financial resources, health insurance, or for whatever reason, some of the children are simply falling through the cracks and not receiving the follow-up service and intervention they critically need. Time is very crucial, and we need to ensure that every hearing or handicapped child obtain these services. My main concern of this bill is it is the potential of creating another Big Brother situation, and in doing so, will it cause even more parents to withdraw their children from the system? I am sure that there are a number of reasons why the parents are not seeking out services for their children's needs when it comes to their health, forcing parents against their will to enroll their children into intervention services in the program is not the answer, nor in creating a situation where the parents feel threatened by the Big Brothers without the threat of losing their children to children's services or some other government agency. Enrollment in the intervention services and programs should always be voluntary and of the parent's free will. I would like to see this bill become on its way through the legislative process. Eventually it becomes law, but only if there is a step taken that will address the concerns that I have mentioned. It will ensure that the families don't feel threatened by this action. Thank you for allowing me to address this afternoon. I have traveled 240 miles just to be here today. Because of this is something that's not only dear and near to my heart, and it's an important issue to the members of the Oregon State Grange. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Jenna Ingram representing the Oregon Academy of Audiology, the group that brought this bill forward. I'm just here very briefly to say that we have reviewed the amendments, the proponents as well as the hospitals and all of the other interested parties. I won't speak for the hospitals, although I have received their okay that they are comfortable with the amendments. They are exactly what we all agreed to during the last hearing. Wanted to address briefly Tammy's concern as well, just by way of reminder that we have included opt-out provisions for parents if they are uncomfortable with the if they are uncomfortable with the testing, it is not mandatory. Also, wanted to just remind the committee that we took great pains, the Newborn Hearing Advisory Committee took great pains in drafting the bill to make sure that we mirror the way metabolic information is handled and to protect the rights of the parents as well as the children under the federal and state requirements for privacy. And, Mr. Chairman, I have been asked to relay to you by the Newborn Hearing Advisory Committee how much they appreciate the expediency with which the committee has dealt with this bill. And my father taught me a long time ago, when they're running at you, don't call them. So I will stop and say thank you. Other questions?
Good advice.
Tammy, I just wanted to say I do believe this is not mandatory. It's maybe mandatory that they follow up and get checked to see what's happening or make sure that they know that they have those opportunities. But I don't believe it mandates that the parents must submit to any type of treatment or lose their children or anything like that. I wouldn't be in favor of that either.
There are times where, it's like with my mother, where she had to go through the SSI program or whatever, and they would always give her the runaround or they pat her on the hand and it's fine, and, you know, and they kind of totally ignored her. But through the other way, if you're trying to get them into these programs and you don't have the resources to do it, you know, it's a catch-22 situation where it depends on that person. So we have to work them out.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks.
And for your long drive.
Ed Johnson. Johnson.
Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnson from Lincoln County. I have some concerns with 401 that brings up a red flag to me. It does not say in here dealing with voluntary. Dealing with Department of Human Resources, as a standard practice, I watch Department of Human Resources tell the, as some people might say, the little people that this is not a voluntary program, this is a mandatory program, and if you don't follow through, you don't get your assistance, and they do get cut off. They do manipulate the, as some people would say, the little people, but they do manipulate the poor on these programs. It's very disturbing to me in the bill dealing with the statement of tracking the recall, tracking the children. To me, that brings a real bad red flag because of the information that is given out and with Department of Human Resources intergovernment agreement agency contracts, information can be even handed out to private businesses and stuff. And this is a very scary, to me, it's a very red flag and concern of this bill that we might not see some of the insights now, but we will see it in 2 or 3 years after it passes, and then we'll go, oh, no, we could prevent this. We should have prevented this. I'm not disagreeing with helping the hearing impaired, but we have to be realistic of what we're setting our children up for. You know, we have to try to look down the road of what this might physically or mentally and emotionally do to not only the families but the children that go through this. Like I said, with a tracking system, we've got enough of those in place. They don't quite work. They do backfire. And without it directly stating that it is a voluntary program where it states that it cannot ever be forced to implement, it says as a program where parents can say no without losing their benefits or losing their rights for any assistance. That's the one thing that we need to be really concerned, because what are we really doing to our children without setting those implements in the bill stating to protect them? That's my main concern. When I read it, I was very concerned, especially with it, because, I mean, with tracking children and that, or even putting chips in them and stuff like that, I mean, Hitler did a beautiful job tattooing the Jews. Are we going to end up doing that to our own children? That's what I like to add, and we need to protect.
A little bit, Ed, here to compare this with a tattooing project. I certainly hope our state people and the folks that are charged with looking into something like this aren't all so tattoos artists on the side.
I don't mean to. Good point, but I was, you know, it just brings up a concern. Is that the possibility that might be looking down the road at us? So.
Well, I think we all have concerns about government entering too much into our lives. But by the same token, and this is not aimed at poor people, or this is aimed at all people who be under this type of situation. And I have found out that it's not necessarily always your income bracket that makes you realize that something maybe is going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that, you know, we had that personal experience with my daughter and didn't know that she was really losing her eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
Until she attempted to get her driver's test, and yet we'd had checkups by an ophthalmologist regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wearing glasses, but they didn't realize that she had an underlying disease. I would have probably not changed things much in her case, but I would have loved to have known it earlier.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I would not disagree with that.
Well, I would think that, you know, there's always situations of euphoria and other things around the birth of a child, and sometimes, you know, people wind up going into childbirth when they're visiting a parent, or not even at their, you know, home of record,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And they could be even on a trip or something like that, and they might easily forget something like that, whereas a reminder or a checkup following that would provide some benefit for them.
Oh, no, I couldn't disagree with that. About all I'm adding is that we need to put a safety...
Well, I don't read anything in here that says that treatment is mandatory. It's a checkup to make sure they have the information, and we're going to ask Dr. Grant Higginson to come up. Well, he's indicated that he was available, and go ahead.
Right. Well, I've just seen it in the past of what goes on in this state. I've dealt with over 300 cases just in Lincoln County on similar things with SCF that were supposed to be voluntary, that they have made sure that it was publicly known basically throughout the community that is mandatory, and if you don't do it, you lose. And, you know, that's where my concern is.
Well, I certainly have no intention of being involved with the continuing...
No, I understand that. I was just saying...
But I feel comfortable with this. And, again, to try to make a bill that's perfect, we'd never get one passed. I mean, it's going to be always subject to changes in...
Very true.
...educational processes, discoveries of medications...
Right.
...and all those things. We need to update things from time to time.
Correct.
So, we have an amendment here to this that... I think also keeps it in the realm of operating within existing budgets and things like that, so that we're not giving a whole bunch of new money to start a whole bunch of people out on a track of doing new things. Go ahead, Grant, and come up, and maybe you can answer some of these.
Thank you.
I saw Dr. Higginson coming forward, and I assumed he wanted to provide us with some further information.
I would like to offer you a parking pass for the Capitol. I don't know if that's within my authority, but I really appreciate your presence. You were here for several other committees that I was on.
Yes.
Appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate it. And I might take you up. But thank you very kindly. I mean, that's just the only concern I had.
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services. And one thing I would like to start off by doing is just thanking the committee for looking at this issue. This actually is an issue that I've been involved in for about 12 years now. About 12 years ago, a parent who had a child who was hearing impaired, now the child at the time was a teenager, but had not been diagnosed early enough, even though they had some concerns. And so she actually went back and got federal dollars by herself to start a program in Oregon, where what we did was mail to all new parents, and particularly those at highest risk, information about hearing screening. One thing we found out about that program, though, was that not all of the children were being identified. And so consequently, two sessions ago, we worked with Representative Lewis, who at the time was very interested in this bill, and came up with the original statute, the original bill that created the statute that you're now modifying. At that time, a number of these concerns about intrusion into privacy and the possibility of misusing tracking information was brought up at that time. And so consequently, the tracking and recall system was not a part of that bill. But we were told at the time that this is something that we did want, that the legislature wanted to know more about, and did we need to do more work in the way of actually tracking and monitoring children on their status in regards to hearing, to make sure that we were getting to families the information that they needed to have. And what we found over the last few years is in fact, that there are still a number of children who slip through the cracks if there is not a tracking and monitoring program. And so that is the entire purpose of this now, to make sure that gap is filled, that families do not fall through the cracks, and that they are getting the information that they need. This is not going to cost the state money, because there are federal dollars available for this tracking and registration system. And as has been mentioned already by previous presenters, this is a voluntary program, so that people who do not want to participate, do not want to be treated, they would not have to. The other thing I would just mention is that in a lot of ways, this really is modeled around the metabolic newborn screening program, where for every child that's born in the state of Oregon, a battery of tests are done to see if they have metabolic disorders that then can be corrected with either treatment or with diet management. And again, it's a voluntary program. I think that we are doing a good job in making sure families have the information that they need to start treating their children as quickly as possible with these disorders that otherwise would not be necessarily identified, and consequently gives the child the best chance that they have for reaching their ultimate potential. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think think you've anticipated everything in advance.
Pardon me?
See, I think you've anticipated everything in advance. Thank you, Grant.
Thank you.
We have a H1 amendment. Pardon?
Thank you.
I guess no one wished to speak to the amendment here in the public hearing.
Thank you.
Just checking on you.
Apparently not. So we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 401 and open a work session on Senate Bill 401.
Mr. Chair, I would move a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 401.
Senator Morissette moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 401. Is there further discussion?
Who's the amendment from?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, this was at the request of the agency, and I know that the hospitals got involved with it. And
oh, right. Okay, never mind. Okay.
Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Parno?
Aye.
Senator
Starr? Aye.
Senator
Morissette? Aye. Aye. Motion carries, and now I would entertain a motion for the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 401 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 401 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Parno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Marzette?
Aye.
Aye. Now we need a carrier.
Senator Fisher, you should carry it.
All right. Okay.
Your name's on the bill.
Yeah.
As long as I get plenty of backup.
Well, see, I don't know. I just voted as a courtesy to get it there. I may speak. No, I'm supportive.
Thank you. Senator Fisher will do the carrying.
You never know about that.
The motion carries and passes, and we will close our hearing on Senate Bill 401 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 9.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 9 had its first public hearing on the 3rd of March, and this comes from Senator Courtney's office. And it would allow an employer to provide coverage under an employer-sponsored health plan to an officer or employee while that person is on military leave. You have two amendments, the dash one amendment, which would allow employers to continue that coverage when the employee is on state active duty or federal duty. The dash two amendment would require that coverage. It would not be, it would be mandatory for state employees only, and that would be when they're on state or federal active duty. I do understand that there will be a fiscal impact for the dash two amendment. We have not received the official fiscal statement. However, Shalee Honeywell from DASC can probably provide some information about that dash two fiscal impact if you're curious.
And they're both here waiting to testify, so go right ahead in whatever order you wish to proceed.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and we have a copy of the fiscal impact on the Dash 2 amendment. And I'll...
Do you have a copy?
I don't have... official copy.
Is that an official?
Well, from legislative fiscal.
Oh.
Let's just say that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
If Colonel Caldwell could talk about the underlying assumptions, I'm assuming there's a fiscal on the dash two and there's not on the underlying bill, that people will think that our agencies won't be providing health insurance, so the whole point of doing the bill would then be the mandatory. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I think that's exactly the case. The in essence, what you have is you have what Senator Courtney, I think, set out to do, which was to offer an opportunity for relief in certain circumstances for people on federal active duty. We asked this committee, and you very graciously indulged us, to expand that to state active duty, which is important because we've experienced a certain amount of, considerable amount of that in the last few years, and that's where it has an impact, a huge impact in both areas, but you know, it's hard to define which one's more than the other. I think for this committee, though, to give you an example, the total number of Army National Guard people who have served in state active duty versus federal active duty, just to give you a quick overview, since 1996, in 96 we had 1,300 state active duty people, 48 federal. 97, 225 state active duty, 52 federal. 98, 475 state, 18 federal. 99, 125 state, 134 federal. 2,000, 700 state, 491 federal. And this year is an anomaly, an exceptional year, because of the activities that are going on in the worldwide situation. Put it in an even clearer context, during Desert Storm throughout the United States of America, the Army and Air National Guard mobilized 75,478 people in Desert Storm. Today, as we sit here, and exactly as of March 11th, National Guard Bureau numbers, 79,935 people are currently mobilized. There's 33,000 more on alert and an additional 20,000 in the pipeline. So we have an exceptional, odd situation that's never occurred to here before. Now, the numbers that I gave you that came from the PEB source basically factor 50 individuals for a period of 12 months being away from their state job and being on federal active duty. That's that economic impact. That, we believe, is absolute the outside. I think it's really closer to 10 if you really get down and look at it, but on a normal expanse. But this is an exceptional year. So
now, may I ask a question,
Senator Morse?
These people are, if they were there, they would be covered, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse said no. If they, what we're talking about basically is if these 50 state employees, what is the number now, 46 currently state employees have been mobilized on federal active duty. Those 46 employees have a form of insurance offered by the federal government for them and their families.
Yeah.
However, in some instances, it doesn't work well for the family because of where they live and the type of insurance that they offer. So this would allow the state to continue their coverage going forth.
Then it's no extra cost if you're going to continue something that's already there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore said, I think from the accounting standpoint, I'll let Shalee answer that, but from the accounting standpoint, yes, indeed, there is a cost because particularly if you backfill, if you backfill an employee, they don't get benefits. So you have a certain number of benefits already calculated for each slot.
Yeah.
So we may have hit something there.
And just sort of a follow-up, if these people weren't on active duty, we wouldn't be getting a fiscal. So basically what whoever's doing this fiscal is saying is that we are saving money by these folks going on federal active duty, and by our having to pay their health coverage, then we're not saving money. That's how I would read this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, that's one way you could look at that exactly, because they would not be taking that benefits, therefore the state would not be expanding it.
That's extremely troubling to me.
Well, and
Senator Moore,
I guess my position is if they were there, you would budget the money for them, and the fact that they leave is not costing you anymore.
Right.
Mr. Chairman.
Could I ask a question, because I don't know the details about the insurance. Are there cases where the federal insurance is actually superior in some cases to the state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, not to my knowledge. The federal government has formed a HMO, basically. And if you're on an active duty military installation, you can use the facilities that are there in conjunction with this HMO called TRICARE. What's occurred in our case, we don't have a military installation other than Umatilla Army Depot that does not have medical care in the state of Oregon. So in order to get medical care for your, say, you and your family, your husband or your spouse, could be your wife in many instances, your spouse has been mobilized, you're left home with the family, you get TRICARE. TRICARE then is offered to certain carriers, and what we've learned in Burns, Oregon, for instance, nobody will accept TRICARE. So we automatically build in a problem. The other anomaly the federal government's done is that if your zip code is different as the soldier than your family's domicile, then you're required to pay a 20% copay, 80-20. So in our case, if we mobilize somebody from the state of Oregon, they're mobilized at Fort Lewis or Fort Carson. Fort Lewis or Fort Carson becomes that mobilization station, which that becomes a zip code, which is clearly different than any town in Oregon. So therefore, everybody gets shoved into the 20% copay bracket.
Mr. Chairman, so to follow up, you're confident that if this were mandatory, that there wouldn't be the unintended consequence of actually reducing benefits for an employee who might otherwise get better benefits, that none of those state employees, in other words, that there wouldn't be state employees who would, in an unintended consequence, actually
lose benefits, right?
Of their benefits.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Shalee Honeywell, and I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, a senior human resource analyst. Hopefully I can clarify a couple of things. It's a unique situation. A part of the fiscal impact statement indicates that we are only looking at spouses and children and not the employee itself when we cover under federal active duty. That is because any of our health insurance programs and health plans would not actually pay out for any injury or illness occurred to the employee while they're in federal active duty. So therefore, this is really based upon covering the spouse and the children. So the employee would be covered under the TRICARE if they're federally activated somewhere. And it would be the spouse and children that would be covered on the mandatory component under a COBRA payment. So you're going to see the cost based upon a COBRA payment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brady, let me just one follow-up on that. Typically in military, if you're injured, you have a reason to receive some sort of medical attention, you go to the military hospital or the clinic, whatever is available where you're at, depending. And then even in a combat situation like we're staging for in Iraq right now, there are hospitals that are backed up at different levels, so you would go to those hospitals. Ultimately, you'd go to maybe a hospital ship, ultimately to Germany back to the United States to a major facility like Walter Reed Army Hospital or something like to that nature. Ultimately, as a reservist, you're going to come back off of active duty when you're able to do that and you're ambulatory, and then you would fall under TRICARE at that point. That soldier would. But they would actually have direct care from the Army, from the Navy, from the Marine Corps, whatever service hospital it is, and it doesn't really matter. They're, you know, where the hospital's there and a soldier needs it, soldier, airman, seaman, whatever, they get that service. It's standard weight based on triage, but that's how it works. It's only when you leave that federal service and you come back and maybe you have other care, the follow-on that needs to be done, then you'd fall under the TRICARE. Otherwise, you're taken care of.
I think what I'm troubled by, I'm assuming that this is a fiscal only on the dash 2 and not on the May.
That is correct.
And I'm curious as to would you assume that none of the agencies then would cover the guard member's family or et cetera, or was there a percentage of agencies that you would assume would cover the families?
Well, this is the difficulty, and that is because each position, depending upon the needs of the position and the duties being filled by that position, when an individual is activated and they leave that position, agency by agency, they make a determination on the need of that position. So there are opportunities to double fill, backfill, create a limited duration appointment for individuals to come in and do the work of that position. Therefore, based upon the position and what can happen with funds or not, or if there's a vacancy that's left, there's many, many different scenarios that could occur for that. However, like I said before, based on policy, the family, the employee can choose through a COBRA benefit to pay the COBRA payment.
Mr. Chair, let me try my question again.
I'm sorry.
The original bill allowed state agencies to cover families. It didn't require it. The Dash 2 amendments require it. I'm assuming there's no fiscal for the non-mandatory coverage. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what was that assumption based on, that no agencies then would cover the families?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, sorry, now I understand. That was based upon that it's optional, and therefore...
No one would do it.
No one would do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask one more question in terms of this? If the employee were not to be on active duty, is this the amount the state would be paying in terms of the family's health insurance costs?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, again, it's very unique. When we look at this, each coverage is different. We went for the highest amount based upon a family rate. Covering your family is the highest rate that the state would pay. And so this amount, however, remember I said we're going to cover the spouse and their children, mm-hmm. which is actually a slightly lower rate okay. than that family medical rate.
Okay. But, Mr. Chair, just
yes,
a follow-up. This dollar figure is actually what we save by those members going on active duty, is it not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, that may not technically be correct, because we could be filling those positions to get the duties done through limited duration
but
positions or double fills.
We don't pay benefits on limited duration positions?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Not on temps.
Temporary appointments, we would not. However, if they do backfill them or do them with a limited duration, yes, we would.
Okay. Thanks.
And so, and just for a qualifier, that's why in number six, the assumption is that 50%, we looked at this number based upon 50% using the alternative limited duration or backfilling, meaning that there could be a double. We're paying doubly there. That's where the dollars come from.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, maybe just one other, just to give you some context. We have one, in our department, we have one section, our installation division, that is losing seven people out of about 60 that are going to this next deployment on the 1249th, and we're struggling mightily to try to find people qualified to fill the positions, because they're rather technical positions. Right now we've got two of those filled, and we're going to be probably a while finding the other five if we even get to that point. And we're debating whether or not we want to do that, because we're looking at some general fund savings to roll into the next biennium. So we're mashing those numbers right now internally. So, and I think everybody, that's pretty unusual that we would get hit that hard in one section. And it's not something that we particularly enjoy, but far be it from us, certainly not to let these people go on to active duty. It would be not a good sign or signal, I wouldn't think. But clearly it's impacting some worse than others. But I think as a general rule, that's an exception, not the rule throughout the state. When seven out of... You got 46, did you say?
Yes.
And we got seven in one section in our organization.
Thanks. And Mr. Chair, if I could make one other clarifying comment. That is, if you look at Assumption 4, however, when we look at the state duty, we look at the difference only really is the $15.82, which is the COBRA cost. It's a higher cost in the COBRA premium versus the regular premium. And so if we took the assumption of Senator Morissette when we talk about that cost is already there, if you looked at federal active duty and looked at really the 50 employees, there would be a marginal cost then taking that assumption all the way through.
Have we sufficiently confused you, everybody?
So what you're basically saying is, as long as this remains a may, that it won't happen.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's basically up to the administration at that point. I think there's some merit. Even if it's, we would, from our standpoint, we'd prefer that it was a will, or you know, you will do this. If that's, you know, given the circumstances of our state at this particular point in time and the good judgment of this group, if you choose not to do that, I think, again, leadership, the governor, commander-in-chief, could, by executive order, decree it to all the state agencies. Now, what that does is take care of the state. It doesn't take care of county, cities, any of that. So I think there's merit in either way you go. Clearly, I think we can make the argument to the governor and his people that this is good business for the state and sends a good signal. And I think this governor would go with the governors I've worked for. This is the fourth one now. I think we'd all probably take this on and do the right thing. That's my personal belief.
Does the -2 amendment, does it make it mandatory for all employers?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it only refers to the state of Oregon. It says an employee of the state of Oregon, not a political subdivision. Yeah, so just the state.
County or city isn't really relevant then in this.
No, sir. You're correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Plano.
Cities, counties, schools, do you have people in the guard that are in school teachers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Clarno, we indeed do. I don't have that number for you, but we basically cross every line, and it's been a fairly popular, devotion to many people in the education community because of the traditional summers off, and they've been able to serve and earn extra funds. So we have a fair number of school teachers, yes, indeed.
Thank you. I guess I just am concerned about the disparity here of having people that are state employees and not looking at city and counties and school teachers.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
To your knowledge, is this sometimes covered in labor contracts with teachers that they get their benefits paid? I don't know.
I doubt if he would.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I don't have personal knowledge of that. I'm sure it could be. And again, I think we're in unusual times right now, and I would tell you that even if we go forward with this, if I've read this thing properly, I think we need to make it worthwhile. We need to change the effective date, and if we're going to do this, we need to do it now, not wait for 2004, because then it's going to be meaningless. And these are unusual times. We've never experienced this. This is the largest call-up since World War II. So, this is not a normal situation we're under.
Well, you're right about that, Colonel. It's being unusual circumstances. I guess I'm debating whether we want to send it down and get it buried at Ways and Means or... perhaps I could ask some of my more learned colleagues here, maybe. If we send it to Ways and Means and it gets buried down there, then we have no vehicle to even go the route of making it optional, do we?
Well, Mr. Chair, I do think while it's down in subcommittee, should Ways and Means not decide not to fund it, we could modify it at that point in time in subcommittee. I guess my feeling is if we're going to pass a bill and nobody's going to comply with it, what is the point of spending the time and energy to pass the bill? And I guess I'm willing to go down to Ways and Means and fight to get this funded, because if we can't pay for our families that whose parents, whatever, spouses are off on active duty to have health coverage while they're on active duty, then it's like, I just think it's worth fighting for.
Well, again, I guess... it would be complied with if we put it in May, and they didn't do it. It's still complying with the bill. And then it makes it questionable whether it's worth fooling around here and wasting the money on doing the bill in the first place, I guess.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clarno.
And I guess I didn't read. I'm trying to find on here where the effective date is. You mentioned 2004. Why do we have that date?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clarno, I understand there's no emergency clause a part of this, and therefore the assumption was that it would be January 1, 2004.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Clarno, this, as was just said, doesn't have the emergency clause, so all bills are effective January 1st. But
Senator Brown's going to go talk to Senator Courtney and see if he would be interested in that emergency call.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
There's no particular reason why we didn't have emergency clause on this. Is that correct?
I don't know of any reason. It just wasn't there.
I think that's what happened.
It just seems to me like if we're trying to address, Colonel, what you're trying to address here, 2004 would be.
Well, we're presupposing, I guess, that things aren't going to get any worse and that we won't have any more of these issues come up, and I'm not so sure that I would necessarily take that particular stand myself.
So, Mr. Chair, if you were interested in an emergency clause, we would have to draft up another amendment for the bill.
Come back.
And we could draft it up two ways. Again, in the permissive language and then in the mandatory language, if that suits you.
I would say that in order to save legislative counsel, if I might.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, that we need to have an amendment to put an emergency clause on this. We should do so. And in that time, if each member of this committee would let the chair know what their preference is on this bill, that would speed up the process and make it more positive.
I think I'll just go ahead and close the public hearing because it's obvious we've got a little work to do on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would appreciate the suggestion that Senator Clarno said if you would just give me let me know, we could have one amendment drawn instead of two.
Just one instead of two.
Yeah, no,
okay. We'll need to know as soon as
there are a lot of these firefighters they're heavily hit.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 9 and okay, if you could get to me and let me know what you prefer, whether it's a
mandatory
or not mandatory. We'll only have one amendment drawn that way.
Okay.
Okay, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 470.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 470 prohibits retaliation by a county against a community mental health and developmental disabilities program that requests mediation or takes another action to address a contract dispute between county and the program.
Mm-hmm. And we have Martin Taylor, and Norm Cayley, and Mike Oliver.
The bill will go to them. Because they're under duty to get
Okay.
If we can get the other one, do that.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here today representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. It's an organization of providers of developmental disability or mental health, primarily in-home services, although with Staley we now have an increasing role in providing, in addition to 24-hour care services, also services that are brought to people's homes. Very briefly, I think we're going to start by giving you a sense of what is the ideal in Oregon in terms of providing services to people with developmental disabilities who need 24-hour care. There was a time in Oregon where a lot of that was done in large institutions like Fairview. We've made a deliberate decision in the state of Oregon to move from an institutional model to a community-based model where now most 24-hour care facilities are located in your communities, where members of the community can have a sense of what these folks are like. And for their part, folks with developmental disabilities can shop at the local grocery store, ride on the local bus, become members of their community, and know what it's like to be part of our society. I think that's a very noble direction for the state to have gone. But structurally, it means that we have a very different relationship with the service providers to developmental disabilities than we once had. in this case, those relationships all run through counties. We receive federal monies that are enhanced by the state and sent to the counties. The counties administer an administrative fee and then contract on the state's behalf with residential care providers. Implicit in this relationship is trust, that in order for providers of a service that often is a home with two or three people living in it, a service that may own three or four or six or ten homes, is that they will have a relationship with the counties that's based on what's in the best interest of the people being served, those clients, those disabled people. And that trust is incredibly important because over the course of a relationship between a residential provider, the people in their care in the county, you're going to have changes in the condition of people who get older and have health problems, facilities that need to be updated, matchings of people as they come and go so that the people that are living together are compatible. That relationship of trust exists in many counties, and unfortunately in a few, it's really torn right now. And that's actually where Senate Bill 470 comes to you. 470 is actually a follow-up bill to a bill that passed in 1999, Senate Bill 141. Senator Fisher was the chief sponsor of that bill. Senate Bill 141 essentially said that counties could not add additional requirements beyond the state requirements for residential care providers, because those additional requirements were costly, and frankly, were creating a hodgepodge of different expectations depending on what county you do business in. It also created a mediation process to try to resolve those disputes in the front end, and an appeals process if there was a dispute about whether or not the contract was in violation of state law. 470 comes to you because that trust still doesn't exist, and in the worst case scenario, one county, when someone used their appeals right to go to state law to contest a contract, discontinued all the services. And I think it's important for you to understand the degree that the consequences of that kind of a broken trust affect the clients. The clients are really the collateral damage in that kind of a dispute. When, in this situation, the county removed services to a provider they were unhappy with, they also broke up homes. People who live in the same house together for 8 or 10 years at a time develop a relationship with each other much like a surrogate family. And for folks with developmental disabilities, frequently the familiarity of your environment and your routine is important. The place that you work is important. The comfort you have going to the same store where people know you is important. The same bus route is important. All of that gets disrupted. Not because anybody has an issue with the client, but because there's a relationship problem between the county and the provider. Senate Bill 470 looks on the surface like a bill that's trying to say counties got to do a better job, counties are the problem, counties are retaliating. This bill goes beyond that. This bill is an indicator that there continues, after 10 years of effort in this regard, to be a more fundamental problem in the relationship between some counties and the providers that do service there, that is undermining the ability to provide these services well for the people that need it. And what our hope that Senate Bill 470 accomplishes is it creates an environment where people are forced to work together rather than get in power struggles. If at the end of a power struggle, the result is the client loses service, loses a sense of family, that's not an outcome that this state wants. That's not the basis of community-based care. That's not why we left an institutional care system. That is contrary to all of the values we've put into this. Our hope is that what will happen with Senate Bill 470 is that there will be less opportunity for power struggles to be played out in a way that at the end of the day, a client ends up losing that kind of support system. Finally, I would say that this bill related to retaliation bears all of the same risks of any bill that tries to address retaliation. And in trying to protect against retaliation, you also open up a set of rights for the people who will claim retaliation, and it requires a certain amount of trust to say that those won't result in frivolous claims of retaliation. I brought with me today a couple of folks who work in this field. In the background, you'll see a room full of people who are there to support them. These are not people who are in the role of care providers for the disabled because they want to frivolously sue people or exercise these rights. These are folks who work for not-for-profit companies. They don't make enormous sums of money. They do it because this is a chosen profession where they are caring for other individuals in home care settings. I think that there's always a risk anytime you grant people protections that those protections will be abused. But I would suggest that this is not a group that's introducing legislation to you today with any hope or expectation of personal gain. All they want to do is be able to provide these services without fear that in advocating for their clients, they could end up losing their ability to provide a service in a home environment that has been established for many years. With that, I want to turn this over to Norm Kohler, who's the president of the Community Providers Association of Oregon, and then there'll be an opportunity for Mike Oliver, who is probably the example of the worst-case scenario, to kind of comment on a specific situation.
Okay. Norm, I apologize for mispronouncing your name here, but I had a little trouble deciphering.
Oh, it's not my handwriting. It's okay.
It's probably Martin.
Sorry. Terrible reading.
Senator Fisher, committee members, my name is Norm Kohler, and as Martin said, I'm the current president of the Community Providers Association, which I'm hoping is only a two-year term. I'm the executive director of Community Access Services.
Two-year term or a two-year sentence?
Anyway, Community Access Services is a private, not-for-profit company whose board consists of parents and other community volunteers, parents of individuals with developmental disabilities. We have provided services, community-based services, for individuals with developmental disabilities in Multnomah County, Washington County, Clackamas County, and Columbia County for the last 15-some years. And what I want to do just briefly is give you a little background to why we're here. And I, you know, if had we the insight we have now, we might have been able to handle this with Senator Fisher in 1999, and we wouldn't have to be back here now. But going back to 1995, through our sponsorship, House Bill 3099 was introduced, and what we were trying to do with that bill at the time is to make some sense out of the differing county contracts. For those of us who worked in multiple counties, it seemed like we were working in different states sometimes. We were having to set up administrative procedures and record keeping for one county that we didn't do in another county. And then there were the things called unfunded mandates, namely additional requirements that turned up in county contracts that we then had to comply with for whatever reason they were there. And what we wanted to do was to at least get start a dialogue with those kinds of things. And when the bill was introduced, the Association of Community Mental Health Providers came forth and said, wow, you know, we didn't understand there was such a problem. You know, we're sympathetic to this in theory, and that we think we can work on this outside of legislation. And I remember talking to Jerry Bieberle, who shepherded our legislation through 5 years ago in Senate Bill 141, where he said in 1998, well, it hasn't worked. As soon as we left the legislative arena, there was no interest on the part of the counties. It wasn't the providers that didn't follow through. And, of course, the counties are all different entities. So we came back to the table with Senate Bill 141, which had wide support from providers all over the state, not just folks in our provider group. That bill was signed into law, and for the first time, providers had an avenue to get someone outside a county involved if they had a contractual problem or a dispute or a difference of opinion around the contract with the county. I have been through a situation of trying to appeal through a county that had different appeal levels, and it was, you know, I sadly learned that it was just one appeal. It just went to different levels. It's just really difficult because of the relationship between a county and a provider seemed to be stacked totally on the side of the county. Again, I want to emphasize it's not a universal problem, and I remember when through our hearings in Senate Bill 141, there was a representative from Clackamas County here, and she was very concerned that her county might have done something to cause us to be here to the table, and we assured her that if our relationship with every county was like it was with Clackamas County, we wouldn't have been here in the first place. In any case, I think that Senate Bill 141 has been a big help. We now have a dialogue with several counties that we didn't have before. They're less likely just to dictate to us. They, by the provisions of 141, come together and discuss county contractual provisions that are not substantially similar to the state contractual conditions. And many of those things we've worked out. So I think the power in the county provider relationship still lies on the side of the county. And I would emphasize that there are normal processes of dealing with bad providers that the county, through licensing requirements, through contractual issues, has plenty of avenue to deal with providers that are not doing their job. What we're concerned about here is providers who have legitimate licenses, providers for whom their services to clients are not in question, but through a disagreement with the county over contractual issues that are outside of or above the state-mandated contract conditions, there's a difference of opinion. And, again, we did not foresee what could happen in this case, and sadly, we feel we have to come back to the table with an amendment in effect to Senate Bill 141.
Does this relate only to issues of the counties that are where they vary from state law?
Yeah, that was the basis of 141.
No, but I mean, does this here refer to that, or does it make it automatic for the overall against the...
Yeah, Senate Bill 141 gives an avenue for mediation to a provider only in those cases where contractual conditions with a county differ substantially from the state contractual conditions. I'm not sure I answered your question exactly.
I'm not sure you did either. What I'm trying to get at is, does Senate Bill 470 only speak to those particular cases, or does it speak to all cases out of contracting with the county?
Well, it was meant to speak to those latter cases and not to all cases, because the county is constrained by the state funding stream in a lot of ways, and we're not trying to get around that, and we're not trying to look for a club to beat the counties up with.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I think you have us at a disadvantage in that we're not attorneys. We have asked legislative counsel to draft a bill for us to relate to this problem. I think that we've been informed that there's a belief among counties that this bill is broader as written than our need. I have unfortunately only gotten that dialogue a half hour before this hearing and have not had a chance to check with legislative counsel to see if they would confirm that claim or not. So the bill is short, and you're all as free to read it as possible. I know there's at least some legal expertise on the committee, but I am not going to pretend to be an attorney and tell you for certain that this bill doesn't capture more to it than this problem that we're trying to solve, which is a resolution to the issue of when a county is trying to extend a contract beyond state law.
Okay, I'm going to reduce the full committee to subcommittee status here, and I'm going to also say that I'm not going to put my committee member attorney on the spot this early in the session over an issue like this. So I think what we need to do, we need to pursue it a little bit, because I, too, just got information handed me here as we started to deal with this bill concerning some of the county commissioners, and it was not a county that had been involved in, from my understanding, taking undue advantage of some of these programs. So I think we better look into that to a little bit more depth before we go on here. So probably what I'll do is try to set up something here where representatives from you folks and from the counties and stuff, we can get together and see, because their indication was that it needs some work if it's going to go forward. So they didn't say that it couldn't go forward, but they wanted to work with it if it did go forward.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, you know, we're certainly willing to engage in that conversation with the counties. We've been trying for 10 years, so hopefully this time we get there. I would say only that you know, there is a really strong hope on our part that there's a commitment on everyone's part to not allow retaliation. I don't know that there's a pro-retaliation position. I mean, it's not really an appropriate response to appealing to a state body to retaliate. I think we just need to be a little judicious that we get to the answer to that problem, even if it isn't easy to get there, rather than let a lot of, sometimes in this process, a lot of smoke will obscure a solution that really needs to take place.
Okay, we're back in full committee. We have a couple more folks that wish to testify, and I have a good colleague sitting here in the back that has been supremely quiet for few minutes, so Senator Shields, would you like to come up and... Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I got ahead of myself. Go ahead, Mr. Oliver. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Oliver. For the record, I am president of Wildwood Personal Initiatives. I believe that Martin has distributed two documents that I had hoped would make it your way. And quite frankly, I am perfectly willing at this point to answer any questions that you may have regarding what Martin presented in terms of my experience with what we're framing as kind of an extreme recent example. And, you know, quite literally, the three of us got together and we kind of mapped out what we were going to say. Fortunately, I chose this seat on purpose, and I was lucky enough to find that both Martin and Norm had covered most of the points that I wanted to make, except for two, and one being that we do hope that the net outcome of this whole process would result in further clarification about what bottom line rights do providers have, or family members, etc., that engage in advocacy under state law. And one of the attachments I've given to you is from a law firm that we have worked with that I hope will lend some direction to your question about does this fit and really what is the need. So having said that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, unless there are any questions, I think what I've submitted probably tells the story as well as anything I could do here today.
Okay, thank you very much. I apologize. I had buried your letter of testimony, which I'll enter into the record here for you, underneath Martin Taylor's. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Apologize for the overlook. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. For the record, my name is Frank Shields, representing portions of Outer East Portland and the community of Happy Valley. I'm proud to join you, Senator Fisher, as the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 470. If you get philosophical for a minute, I think in the natural order of things, you would hope, you'd like to believe that a bill like this is not necessary. There ought to be a partnership between families of developmentally disabled or mentally ill people and the not-for-profit residential care facility, that side, and the other side, the counties who administer the contracts and case management for these services. And in most counties, I think that kind of harmony exists. In some counties like mine, though, I believe that there is a level of distrust and tension. I've been exposed to it as I've watched some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that led to this bill. I see this bill as a tool to keep a lid on that tension so it doesn't boil over. It's also a bill intended to prevent the clients and families served in residential care facilities from getting caught in a crossfire when conflicts occur. I think if everybody knows that there's a real consequence to retaliation, that retaliation is less likely to occur. This will also encourage all parties to make a greater effort to seek mediated solutions rather than power struggles. The big picture is that these are very tough times for these kind of human services programs. We all know that in the context of the budget that we're in. Oregon's vulnerable people are already terrified of losing services. The counties have been forced to make major cutbacks to lay off employees. The largely not-for-profit providers of 24-hour residential care are also really struggling. They've been asked to forego cost of living increases due to our budget shortfall. They expect this next budget will do the same for the next 2 years. At the same time, their costs are shooting through the roof, whether it's higher energy bills or liability insurance or the nursing shortage or the higher minimum wage or whatever. You get the picture of the kind of world that they live in. Now, while I can't imagine an opponent to Senate Bill 470 coming here today to argue that retaliation is a good thing, I can imagine that there is concern about Senate Bill 470 in that it is simply not the most important issue facing DD and mental health delivery systems today, because we've got such other big problems. But I encourage you to pass Senate Bill 470 in that it could be one of the smaller steps to make sure you don't have the same kind of stability in our state delivery system. We're running a risk, I think, that if retaliation can occur in one or two places at times, that it can occur with more frequency, and it could create a scenario in which more and more people might be leaving the arena of providing these kind of services because it just gets too difficult. And I'm at the end of being in some of these homes and seeing the people, and I just wonder where they'd turn if some of these facilities, and I've talked to providers, groups of 25 and 30 of them gathered in one place, and some of them, you know, say, hey, this is getting too difficult. Maybe I can serve a different clientele, you know. So when I hear that kind of thing, I begin to wonder if, you know, where some of these people go to services if that happens. Sorry I didn't have a chance for better organized testimony. I'm sitting in Ways and Means, and I think I left 3/4 of my brain down there.
How about your pocketbook?
You check your pocketbook before you go into those hearings.
Senator, you've been a cohort of mine on many Health and Human Services Committee, and I've kind of taken a powder on this one this session. And I go back to the fact of all of the arguments we've had in the past concerning counties that added additional burdens onto their providers when they were unwilling to pay anything more than what the state was willing to pay in the program. And I never felt that I was very successful in warding them off. It's been frustrating to me from that standpoint because they wanted to rule and regulate and add on to things, and I can't remember whether you were on my side. I don't recall that we were able to do this because it did hit counties that you're very near to. Mm-hmm. And I believe you're beginning to see what maybe I saw before.
Well,
in the problems that you have when you get multiple servant or multiple masters over a servant that doesn't have much to say for himself as far as his destiny. And it's not good, but by the same token, I want to enter a letter here from former Representative Dennis Luke, who's now commissioner over in Deschutes County. And as I recall, Representative Luke, when he was here in the legislature, didn't go along too much with the counties taking those kind of liberties with people either. And now he, as a county commissioner, is saying, hey, you know, don't get all counties involved in this. And that's why I was asking Martin the questions I was asking about, is this just 141 issues or is this all counties? And if it does open the door to all counties, then I think perhaps we've got to rethink this just a little bit. But I am not sorry that I sponsored it. I think we're having a good hearing here, and things haven't gotten out of hand, and nobody's taking clubs and brickbats to each other, so we've got a workable situation here. I would like to work on it a little more with you, and even though you're not on my committee now, you're on the Health Policy Committee, right, and you're still involved with these issues.
Right. A quick comment. First, if you go back in history, you know, this would be part of Jerry Bieberle's legacy for all of us. I mean, because he started a process. I don't think that everybody, especially the People's Republic of Multnomah County, has particularly listened to the legislature. You and I were on the same side on the issue back then. You're right in that maybe we need to make sure that everybody doesn't get painted with the same brush here, so I'd be glad to see you do a little work to tighten it up, narrow it, get the parties together and straighten it out and come back with something that addresses the specific attitudes of a very few of the 36 counties.
Senator Brown.
Can I ask more of a theoretical question for Senator Shields?
Sure.
I have consistently opposed mandatory joint custody for parents of a child because when those two parties can't agree on something, who makes that decision, i.e. the child goes to synagogue or church or whatever, temple or, you know.
I just love your illustration.
Well, it was the first one, Kiki, no pun intended. I think, I guess, obviously, this has been an ongoing, or at least to some extent, an ongoing dispute between what appears to me one particular county and its providers. I mean, other than us saying, you know, get along, do this right, I mean, is us passing a bill, will it really make a difference? I mean,
I know it's a theoretical question, but I would react by saying if it's got the attention of the other counties that have gone along and they're wanting to make sure that it doesn't overreach, then it's probably striking a happy medium on the couple that haven't necessarily listened. I know I'm not as clear as I should be, and I don't think I want to get any clearer than that, lest there be some retaliation that I would end up facing. Okay?
Okay. Thanks.
We have Paul Snyder, and I guess that's it, unless someone else out there wishes to come forward. Come ahead, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. There are a number of aspects to this bill that give us a great deal of concern. And I'd just like to give you some idea what some of them are. I think it's correct where the proponents indicate that the previous legislation from 99 moves us in the direction of mediation. I would suggest to you that this moves us the other direction. It means it moves us toward litigation and right out of the mediation. It provides for a minimum award of damages. It says that no matter what your damages are, you're going to get at least $1,000. So if your damages are $10, you get $1,000. If your damages are $1,000, you get $1,000. It also provides that the plaintiff, but only the plaintiff, is entitled to attorney's fees if the plaintiff wins. Another aspect of it has to do I used to work at Legislative Counsel's office, and we used to chuckle about a bill that had been drafted years ago where it says dog includes cat. Well, in this situation, retaliation includes alteration. So nobody wants to get in a position where we've been labeled as having retaliated, but if retaliation includes any modification in the contract itself, and then the rest of the bill kicks in, that's a serious problem. This bill breaks new ground. The statute of limitations for torts is 2 years. Statute of limitations for contracts is 6 years. This makes a claim under this statute 7 years, but it applies only to providers for mental health and developmentally disabled services. So we're creating a whole new statute of limitations for a very narrow category of people. And why somebody needs 7 years to figure out why they were upset about the way the contract was changed, we don't understand. But it places the county in a situation where you purge files, where people have come and gone, they don't work here anymore, nobody remembers what the case was about, and then 7 years later you get filed a lawsuit against you and you haven't got the capacity to defend it. Another is a provision that exempts a claim under this bill from ORS, a series of statutes that relate to punitive damages. And it says basically a claim, well, first of all, it creates a claim that has never existed before, and that's a claim for punitive damages against government. It doesn't exist under Oregon law. It doesn't exist under federal law. This is a whole new situation. The reason why punitive damages are not awarded against government is because it's taxpayers' money that's being paid to the plaintiff in that situation. So this applies these kinds of claims to claims for punitive damages, but it goes farther than that. This says that the statutes that apply to everybody else in a punitive damage claim would not apply to a county under this case. And so, therefore, the statute that says that punitive damages are not recoverable in a civil case unless it's proven by clear and convincing evidence that the party has acted with malice or has shown a reckless and outrageous indifference to highly unreasonable risk of harm and has acted with conscious indifference to the health, safety, and welfare of others would apply to everybody except the county. If an award of punitive damages is made by a jury, the court shall review the award to determine whether the award is within a range of damage that a reasonable juror would be entitled to award, unless the defendant is a county. In addition, the court may reduce the amount of any judgment if the defendant establishes the defendant has taken remedial measures that are reasonable under the circumstances to prevent recurrence of the conduct, unless the defendant is a county. Finally, there's a provision in the law that applies to, again, everybody else. It says that in the event that punitive damages are awarded, then 40% shall be paid to the prevailing party and 60% shall be paid to the criminal injuries compensation account unless the defendant is a county. Mr. Chair, there are a couple aspects to this bill that are of concern. Mr. Oliver's handouts outline for you what the issues are, the particular case about which they're making reference. But there were no copies for the audience. We don't have them, so we don't know what his allegations are. We have people from Multnomah County here prepared to defend, but they don't know what the claim is, and so they're not going to be able to respond to it because they don't know what the complaint's about. I can tell you, from my understanding, is that this case is in litigation, and the county has won the first round. Mr. Taylor has indicated that he hopes this creates an environment where people are forced to work together. I'd suggest to you that the way this legislation is drafted, it just does the opposite of that. It places counties in an untenable situation where the only serious choice is to roll over because the cost of losing is too high.
You know, this is a sad thing, and I'm not just sure how long you've been involved in the process, whether you were around when we were working on some of these other things and attempting to straighten up a couple, three of the counties that we felt that were taking advantage of these folks. And certainly got no help from Association of Oregon Counties. Mm-hmm. Now, instead of, it seems to me, going up and pounding the daylights out of three or four counties that have caused this to come about because of their recalcitrance, you're now begging for your life like others have been begging for their life literally back through time. I'm sympathetic to your situation because my
position, I believe, is to be fair, not vindictive. And so I don't necessarily think in fair would be, being fair necessarily is extracting as many pounds of flesh out of the counties to straighten this thing up as what the counties have taken out of other people's hides in the past. But at least we need to get the situation straightened up so we walk out into a brighter tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, we'd be pleased to work with proponents of the legislation to find out what the issues are and what the responses are, because I believe there are responses, and figure out how we can resolve the cases in a way that works to the advantage of the people who live in these facilities, because I think we all share that concern. Nobody, including counties, especially counties, want to hurt the people that we provide the services to.
Do they share that concern enough that they're willing to back out of the regulation and the requirements and things that are all extra that they're requiring to have these people do over and above what the state is willing to pay for?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question because I don't know enough about the programs and what our members do. But we can have AOC, MHP, and AOC working with the proponents of the legislation to identify their concerns and find a way to address them. I'll commit to do that.
I'll accept that commitment. I'll instruct staff to set up a meeting with the folks involved here so that we can get it started. And I'm not exactly sure who all the proponents should be, but certainly folks that represent the counties. Yeah, we'll work on this as quick as we can, but I do intend to bring this back and work on it. Yes, Senator Brown.
I guess, Paul, what I'm troubled by this is that it's apparent that the provider community has come forward. This is now the third time in less than a decade because of difficulties in dealing with the counties, or one particular county, I'm not sure, or at least more than, you know, there's a couple of counties that are problematic, or allegedly problematic. Do you perceive that there is a problem? And if so, how would you describe that? And if you don't, that's okay. I'm just kind of curious about what AOC's perspective is on this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm here because I do the legal stuff. And we looked at the bill and our eyes kind of popped out. And I don't know to... I don't think, but I'm welcome to be corrected, that we've been approached in terms of negotiations with respect to these concerns before the bill was dropped or before this hearing. If we have, then
I'm not sure about
this
before this hearing either, but this certainly has been come up and been pretty thoroughly discussed and worked on before, always with the counties absolutely demanding that they not be limited in any way, shape, or form of doing what they wanted to do with these folks. And it's been extremely, and even to the point where one county next to another county causes all kinds of different problems with homes operated by the same individual that has homes in both counties. And the problems are manifold when you have to try to run operations like that. And I can say that, you know, I operated nursing homes in several different counties. There's no way under the sun. You know, it's one thing if a county had a business tax or something like that, you know, and one county didn't, that's one thing. But if one county has a whole bunch of rules and regulations I got to follow and that they're not willing to pay for it, and the state says we aren't willing to pay for it because we're not requiring it, you can hear me yelling bloody murder, and that's what these folks have been doing. And there's been, you know, I'm sympathetic, and I'm not going to hurry this bill through the process without you folks having a chance to work on it and get in your two bits, because I said I'm here to be fair, not vindictive. But I have been thoroughly disgusted with the attitude taken by these counties that we will do it and we won't pay for it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morrison.
With all due respect, Paul, having been a mayor for many years and having dealt with the League of Oregon Cities and being from an individual city, I see sometimes a disconnect between the association and the city, and I, you know, you don't have any authority over what your individual counties do, right?
That's correct.
But you do, you're here to protect the county association, well, to be a spokesperson for the county association in general. And so I see your role as a dual role. One of them is to make sure that laws are not passed that negatively impact counties in general that may or may not be in part of this. And secondly, to understand where the problem is within the county, within your organization, and deal with those counties and deal with the proponents of this bill and try to resolve the issue. So I hate to paint, you know, I don't want to paint counties or cities with the broad brush because they're different. So I appreciate your being here, and I think it's great that you are. We are going to go back because, you know, if the counties who are, well, the good county commissioners may leave and some other ones come on, do something, you know. So I guess the question then is this a law that is going to do more harm than good? Is it, you know, so there are a lot of things that we need to consider, and I do appreciate your giving that point of view. So good luck.
Thank you so much, Senator.
Comments or questions? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 470?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Winner.
Just a point of information from staff for the record. I'm assuming these are state dollars that are going through the counties to the providers, correct? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think it's state and federal and perhaps local as well. A combination of those things.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm glad you're informed. That's what we need to do. Okay, we have completed our agenda, and I will adjourn our committee for the day. Thank you very much, members.
Because maybe we don't want to be counted.
The AAA about they brought that. I said, don't do it. Don't take it.
Yeah.
What if they stop funding? And they said, oh, we'll give it back. Well, they've never given it back.
Right,
and I think
exactly.
That counties and cities should be very careful what they
contract. I think you're right.